Is it a dumb game, or am I just dumb?
What's dropping?
If you are looking for relevant gaming coverage from experts, you are not getting it on this show.
There's this thing that I've been noticing lately at coffee shops in particular, but anywhere in public.
Is it a stench? Is it something that you can smell?
There's certainly a coffee stench. I don't know if you know that stench. It's very bizarre. It's like coffee. The coffee itself smells really good, but then the coffee shop smells like a wet cigar or something. It's awful.
Yeah.
But this is something, this is a behavioral thing that I've noticed. And it has to do with parents. And parents, I love you. You do a job I will never do.
Speak for yourself. I can't stand my parents. We don't get along at all. They can rot in hell.
Says 1994 Chris as he sweeps his Crispin Glover hair over his eyes and fixes his flannel.
You think you know me. You don't know me at all, man. I'm not like you, Dad.
So this is a behavioral thing I've noticed that parents do with their kids. And I mentioned this to you briefly, Chris, but I want to get more in detail and see if you've ever noticed people doing this. It annoys the living hell out of me. It's parents, a single parent generally. That doesn't mean that they don't have a husband, wife, or partner or whatever. Just that they're alone with their child. Will do this thing where they see themselves as in this kind of comedy duo with their kid, and then they implicate everyone around them as if we're spectators, paying audience members to this brilliant comedy duo. And this really got brought to my attention last time I was at a coffee shop, and the woman ahead of me had her daughter, and her daughter was running fucking wild, of course.
It's the worst. Get that kid under control. Put it on a leash.
But the woman kept saying like, oh, Louise, don't touch that. You know what we were talking about. Louise, that's not for kids. Get over here. Oh, Louise, do you want a snacky with your milk? Do you want a snacky? And with every line she would say, she was uttering it loud enough so that everyone nearby could hear. And then she'd look out of the corner of her eye or kind of glance over to me like, oh, she's at it again. And like, and this all culminated with her going like, oh, Louise, like this is a catchphrase to an 80s sitcom. And yeah, we were all going to go, oh, it's just that, Louise, and fold up our arms and like, you know, do a tisk tisk gesture with our hand or something. Oh, Louise, it's not funny, nor is it entertaining, lady. I could give a shit. It's 8 a.m. I don't care about your kid. I just want to get my coffee. You are not Hannibal Buress. You are not Kyle Kinane. This is not meeting my threshold for humor.
I think what it is that they're, I have to be careful because I know people with kids.
What you're trying to say is you know people that have done this to you.
Yeah, I've been witness to it, and I've been witness to the whole, the worst part about it, I think I'd be okay with it if they were doing it and they were blocking out the outside world. It was just them and Louise and they didn't care about what everyone else thought. It's when they do that whole, like after they do the, oh, Louise, like when they look to everyone else, that's when it becomes uncomfortable for me because now they're trying to rope me in. And what they're trying to do in some small way is sort of say like, check out the relationship I have. Yeah. You want in on it? No.
Yep. It's like, this is so special over here.
Yeah.
You gotta get in on this.
And I don't at all. I usually, if if you were to ask me very politely to get in on it, I would say, fuck you and Louise. I don't care. I mean, I need my caffeine or whatever I came in here for, and then I'm out.
By the way, of course this little girl's name was Louise. Like,
is that true? Is that?
Yes.
Oh, God.
Of course it was, because it was a hipster, baby.
Louise.
She had overalls on. She had wild, brave-like, unkempt red hair. No, she had Mario Batali clogs on. This Louise is bound for art school.
Yeah.
And
she has already been pre-registered at the Tisch School of Performing Arts at NYU. Her trajectory has already been dictated. She will live in the East Village or possibly Soho. It depends on how the neighborhoods evolve. You know, they already know where she's going. It's disgusting in many, many ways. But, you know, Tanner, we could, you and I are childless. Tragically, my balls were hit with a Nerf gun when I was a kid, and I'll never have children. I mean, that's just the reality of it. So, and I don't know what your situation is. You might be a bull in heat for the most part. I mean, I don't know.
I'm a freak in heat. And I'm a, what was the other part of that Two Live Crew? I'm a freak in heat.
Oh, God.
I'm a something without warning. And your butt in those jeans makes me so horny.
Is it a dog without warning?
I'm a freak. Wait, I'm like a dog in heat. I'm a freak without warning.
Yeah, that's because that's from Me So Horny, right?
Yeah.
I'm like a dog in heat. A freak without warning. I have an appetite for sex. Must be so horny.
What an amazing band Two Live Crew was.
Like, they were great.
It was all about coming out with the rawest, most sexual shit to scare the crap out of white people.
And they did. I remember sitting on the stoop at a friend of the show, Eric and George's house, and we were singing the lyrics to Band in the USA because the music video would come out. And I don't even think we understood technically why they might be banned in the USA or what they would be banned for. We just knew that they did something naughty. And when you look back, all of it was stupid. Anyway. Hey, you want to do stuff about games this week?
Let's wedge it in, I guess.
I mean, I've got a lot of other stuff I'd love to be talking about, but we, back in August, September, whatever it was when we conceptualized this show and it was birthed from our brains, it was a gaming podcast. And ladies and gentlemen, I believe this would make this episode 26. We have passed the quarter century mark.
Isn't it, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's two baker's dozens, right?
You finally got the math correct.
I've been obsessed with this baker's dozen.
We're going to just keep running with it now. Ladies and gentlemen, wait until we reach episode 36, if my math is correct on my end. I don't know. Hey, excuse me. That was me clearing my throat to sound as though I was reining in the show. I'm going to kick it off. I played more Diablo 3 this week.
Wait. Let me clarify something, because I'm confused.
Sure. Yeah, go for it.
Are you playing the expansion, Reaper of Souls?
Nope. I'm playing the core game, and I don't know why I am continuing. It's not like it's fun.
Well, wait. I've heard the expansion is really, really good.
Well, in the ramp-up to the expansion, which is when I began playing, that's when they made all of their adjustments. And so the single player game, admittedly, it's way more fun than it was the first time around. But I feel like I've been talking about this already for three episodes, so I don't want to go too in depth on the different changes they made. But what I have been enjoying, or what I guess is actually sort of, I don't know, roped me in, is that XP is up like 50%. So my character in that game is already at a higher level within the, I don't know how many hours I've sunk in. Maybe, I don't know, 12 tops? Not even. There's no way it was 12. So I've surpassed all of my old characters that I had on my first account.
Wow.
If you're getting double the XP that you would have gotten off of kills, plus you get loot that also adds to how much XP you get and how much money you get. I mean, I'm a god in the game. There's no defeating me, which is fun to an extent, but it makes replayability become a bit boring. As I'm talking about this, I haven't played it in about 12 hours, and I'm thinking I would love to play again just to get through a level or two or whatever, just because it's fun to be in God mode in a way.
I get what Blizzard's doing, though. They seem to be going this way with WoW as well, where they want to make it as easy as possible for people just to blow through the content. And then what they do is have hooks in there for people who are more into challenge. So, you know, in WoW, that's the end game. And in Diablo, that would be nightmare mode, of course. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, and they're, you know, with World of Warcraft, I think their most recent thing was that they, what was it? You could level one character up to 90 instantly. Like, if you had a character in your stable that was level 70 or something from your old account, let's say, you could take him. What was your character's name? Domitian? We could have taken Domitian and immediately put him at level 90 so that you can experience endgame. They just want you to get into the endgame portion as quickly as possible. And then your other characters, I think, would experience an XP boost as well. That way they can get into that portion of the game. I kind of have a problem with that because, and this is the issue I ran into actually with World of Warcraft. When I was playing in later levels, I got really upset that I couldn't go back to, you know, once you get out of a certain leveling area that is made for, you know, level 45 to 55, or if you're lower level, you know, 15 to 25 might be the range. Once you beat that area, and I put that in, you know, in quotes, because you never beat an area, you just leave it behind. Once you've done that, you have no reason to go back. And I always wanted them to make you compelled to go back to those early areas. I don't know. And when you get near that end game, there's no one who's making a level one character. So there's no fun in making a character. There's no fun in the reroll because no one else is doing it. I don't know. I get very frustrated about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I have a mixed opinion about it. I mean, especially because my fondest memories in Warcraft were, you know, it's cliche, but the journey is the fun thing in those games. It's yep. The scrapping it out in shitty zones with your buds, grinding away. And MMOs, in some weird way, becomes the stuff that I'm nostalgic about, as opposed to the big events. And, you know, I don't remember any loot I got, but I remember some crappy night at 3 a.m, about 12 coors deep, fucking around, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you're hanging out in Durotar. You have no business. Like, why would you even be hanging out in Orgrimmar when you should be, you know, doing this other thing? You should be in, what was it, like the Thundering Steps or whatever it was just south of there. And but you're fucking around in there because you're trying to, you're trying to best a boss with a bud. You know, things like that made that game so much more fun. And when I got to, at the time, what was endgame, I believe it was level 70. When I got into that realm, between 60 and 70, well, actually, do you remember, I'm sorry to hijack this and make this about World of Warcraft, but do you remember how fun it was when you got to, like, Hellfire Peninsula, when the game suddenly opened up into a larger world, even the larger than the world that you had already been in, and you get there and there's this huge war going on and you're just like a recruit in the effort and you're riding on shit and dropping bombs on stuff from the tops of griffins and whatnot. Do you remember how awesome that was?
Yeah, that was definitely a cool moment because they had the whole portal.
Yeah.
So you shifted between worlds and like when you came through that portal, you were coming in hot.
Yeah, you know? And there was no turning back is what it felt like. Like, once you step through this portal, the world, the game was the same, but the players are going to change, is what they're telling you.
I think you got that, dude.
I got it totally mixed up. Don't worry. Scratch that, reverse it. It works. What have you been playing?
I've been playing Dark Souls 2, and
so mainstream.
Mainstream is what you said?
Yeah, so mainstream, dude.
It is kind of interesting how that game, I think the game feels mainstream. I don't know that it actually is.
when it first came out, or when its predecessor was what was it called?
Dark Souls, Demon Souls.
Demon Souls. When I first bought my PS3, I bought Demon Souls. And my brother bought it too because we thought that it might be a multiplayer type game that we could enjoy together.
And you got trolled.
Holy
hard.
Shit, did that turn out to be a big mistake? Because the multiplayer component, and I don't know if they kept this, if this carried over, you can let us know, but it was multiplayer only in the sense that you could see, like, other players could leave a message for you saying, up ahead is this thing, or don't look left, or whatever it was, and so you'd see that, and you might heed their warnings, and then you could sometimes, every so often, you would see, like, the spirit of another player who was running through, and you would see what would happen to them and their demise. Did they keep that game mechanic at all in these new Dark Souls games?
Yeah, they've kept that. They incentivize it now. You can rate those messages, and if people rate your message highly, you get a reward.
Okay.
You can also bring in friends to help fight with you.
Into your actual game world?
Yeah, and...
What do they get out of it?
They get experience.
Okay, all right.
And you can also get invaded by other players.
Ooh, I don't know if I like that.
That is hilarious and infuriating all at the same time. Anytime it happens to me, it's a guy that, or girl, or whoever, that can just wreck me. You know, if someone's invading, they're built to invade. And they come in like a goddamn fucking steamroller and just plow you over.
So does the game place them near you? How do you know when they enter the game? Do they...
A message comes across your screen, you are being invaded, and then you just wait. And the couple times it happened to me, it's like all I see is some dude hauling ass to me. And then
armored,
like,
to the hilt.
Yeah, in like two hits, I'm done. You know, there's no means to even prepare.
Is there audio? Can they talk? Can they say something to you?
No.
Like, okay. That's actually funnier.
The game, it's one of the most fascinating games. And if you are really into video games, it's a thing you just have to play to kind of say you have played. And it's like the death metal of games.
Yeah. That's a good way to describe it.
It's like leather and chains. You know, it's dark as fuck. It's so metal. It's punishing. But it has that tinge of hilarity that metal has, you know?
Right. Like,
it's so over the top that it folds in upon itself and it becomes Spinal Tap in a way. But so far, I played about 8 to 10 hours of Dark Souls. I set it aside because it was giving me so much anxiety. It was like, I'm going to play another game. And then it became insurmountable to start playing again. But Dark Souls 2, I'm here to report, is a better overall experience, especially if you're just looking to try the series out. It's still complex as fuck. Confusing, severely Japanese. But I've been trying to think of why it's a bit easier to get into, and I've been told by veteran players that it's even harder than Dark Souls, but it's easier to get into. And I think what it is first of all, there's a tutorial that tells you a few things. It's mostly useless, but at least you don't start off in the shit. It kind of gives you some instruction. But then the first area you get to is kind of a hub world. Well, not quite a hub world, but a safe place. And then the first zone you should go to is designed in such a way as to be less punishing than the undead Berg in Dark Souls, where you had to defeat a series of enemies between save points that would require severe memorization and very quick twitch skills. Here, the enemies are spaced out enough and easy enough to defeat that you're not getting hammered from the very beginning. And that's a nice change. The menus are still confusing as fuck, even though they changed them. The game is still, it's like staring at a menu screen in Dark Souls is like staring at the Rosetta Stone. Like, there's worlds of knowledge there, but you don't quite understand it. You have to, absolutely go to the forums and talk to other people to find shit out. But that's what becomes so amazing about the game is it unravels and unravels and like a fractal keeps revealing new things. You know, more of the same, but with greater depth.
In Demon's Souls, I remember, a component of the game was you were trying to... I think you actually started the game off as being alive, but quickly would, no matter what, unless you were a brilliant player, would die. So then you have to reclaim your soul by beating the end person of whatever stage. But there was this this area, this staging area that you could go to, like a home base or whatever you want to call it. And within that, at the very top level, there was this Hall of Fame of sorts where you would see statues and it would tell you what gamer scores were out there. And in Demon's Souls, every name was Japanese and every point score was like 100 billion and all. I mean, it was out of control. It was like watching somebody who had, they clearly had played on some sort of god mode. Do you get to see that? Is there some kind of like a hall of trophies or anything like that where you see other players' progress?
I haven't encountered that. I mean, but you're kind of getting to an interesting point, which is I think Dark Souls, more so than almost any other game out there right now, is really innovating what multiplayer means. You know, and they're trying to find new ways in a very Japanese, with a very Japanese sensibility, where you're not so much playing with other people as you're seeing shades of the community around you within the game, I think. And I like that quite a bit. And this leads me to what I would like to talk about in the third segment. I want to talk about this really interesting issue of what is or what characterizes both in the past and currently Japanese game design.
Oh, man, that's heavy. Okay. All right. It's something I can think about. Okay. My brain's going. The gears are turning. You can hear them, ladies and gentlemen. So, I guess before that, though, we'll have to do... we have to do the news. I know sometimes it sounds like here at Super Dumb Games, we have a certain genre of game that we like. For instance, it sounds like, I would imagine most people think that you and I just love role-playing games.
True, true.
Yeah, but they'd be wrong.
What?
Yeah, we hate them. I've never been a fan. I can't imagine you've been a fan ever. I think we talked about like Final Fantasy VI, which was 3 or whatever. We know the facts. We don't like those games. You know what we like? We like this type of game because it's what's dropping. Caliber 10 Racing Series. Racing games are the blood of Super Dumb Games. We love racing games. What's the last racing game you ever played, Tanner?
God, that's a good question. Last racing game I've ever played. Holy shit. I think we've got to go back.
This is a tough question because I can't think of... I mean, outside of the arcades, but I don't think that counts. You go to the arcade, playing a racing game is a totally acceptable experience.
Let me take you back to a time right before the turn of the century.
Holy shit.
December 23rd, 1999, Gran Turismo 2 came out.
For the regular PlayStation?
I think it was for the regular PlayStation. That might have been the last time I truly played a racing game.
I can't imagine a racing game coming out that would compel me to buy it. But this one just might be it, folks! Caliber 10!
Somehow I doubt it.
Oh, well, let me read about the game first, because I haven't even read this, but let me read about it, and then maybe I'll tell you at the end if I'll buy it. Caliber 10 Racing Series, about the game. present day takes place at an undisclosed time in the near future. That sentence.
Wait, okay, let's break it down. Let's go bit by bit. It's the present day, established.
Okay, takes place at an undisclosed time.
All right, wait. I'm already confused. We just stated it was present day, which would be...
But let's break...
I'm saying March 26th. We're recording this on a Wednesday. You're hearing on a Monday. But that's the magic of podcasting. But still, by Caliber 10's initial phrasing, I would believe it was taking place on 3/26/2014.
But let's do this in that way. You remember in what was that, chemistry, where you would do, like, you would cross out, like, you would take days, and then on a line to the bottom right, you would have days, and you'd cross cancel those out because you would break it down. And,
yeah.
Just like a mathematical chemistry problem. Present day, that's today, takes place at an undisclosed time. I'm breaking this down into now minutes of the day or hours of the day, let's say.
Okay, that's a leap of logic, but we'll accept it. So we're establishing that it is 2014, probably March, April-ish. But the details here are flexible in terms of precise minute or day.
Yes, it could be morning, afternoon, evening, you know, it could be dawn or dusk, it could be the witching hour. We have no idea. It's an undisclosed time of that particular present day.
Okay.
In the near future.
Wait. Wait, no, I think we're still on pace. I'm checking the math. So, we've established it's March, April 2014. There's some flexibility, but that flexibility, we're going to fudge it towards the future. So we're going into April at this point because it's a near future.
Okay.
So Caliber 10 takes place sometime in early spring 2014.
Okay. Okay. So that first sentence has been digested and shat out. We understand now where the game's... Oh my god. A major catastrophe has disrupted the global economy. I love that it's the economy that's been disrupted most, not the people that are uprooted. It doesn't explain, maybe it does, I haven't read this at all, but why are you racing? If the global economy has been disrupted, the last thing you do is you go out in a car and race. In my mind, like, to me, it's sort of like you hoard and you kill neighbors, but you don't race cars. A major catastrophe has disrupted the global economy to the point where there is only one televised sporting event left in the world. It is called The Running Man, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger.
No, wait.
No, okay. Wait. I added that in. But that would be awesome, though, if in the back... Go on.
But they are saying that there is only one sporting event left.
Yeah.
So this...
The global economy... has crushed baseball. The NFL completely bankrupt.
The little, you know, many things get considered when an economy collapses. But one of the things people don't often think about is what sports would be left. Because that's really fucking important.
And I think, I think the important takeaway is that when considering which sports to eliminate, you know, first goes the NBA. We all know that.
Racist, racial.
That's not true. My favorite player of all time is Larry Bird. So wait, no, hold on. Anyway, okay. But we all know that what falls to the wayside are the most popular sports for an economy,
and all that is left is the XFL. Who has the last laugh, Vince McMahon?
What was that guy's name? He hate me or you remember that was
oh
like
my god, you just blew my mind. I haven't thought about that since he hate me exist. What is he hate me doing right now?
He's racing in the C10 racing series. because the C10 Racing Series is the largest and most popular event in the world, sponsored by the world's mega corporations. I thought we said that this is dystopia where economic catastrophe has struck, but there are still mega corporations. Get your shit together, C10! Stock prices are determined by the outcome of races for these sponsors. Driver and shooters are well-paid heroes for billions of viewers around the world. The spectacle of the races are legendary and take place at locations all around the globe, including even the most stricken, like the most poverty-stricken of places. I don't know. It seems like they're an equal opportunity race place, though. I don't know. Four teams of two. One driver and one shooter, each team battling it out to be the first to cross the finish line. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Road Rash with a driver driving for you while you whip people with a chain.
It's Road Rash crossed with Lucky and Wild.
What is Lucky and Wild?
What?
Hold on. I don't know if I know what this is.
You have to. It's one of the great arcade machines of all time. It was a two-player cooperative driving game where one player was the driver and the other player had like two pistols.
I know this game already. I okay, I'm dumb. This is the ones that starred the you would get seated in the game, and I believe that you had a stereotypical like brunette and a blonde dude, right?
Yeah.
Those were your... Yeah, that's Lucky and Wild. That's their names, ladies and gentlemen. That's not just... It's a play on words because it's their names and it's how you... It's how you digest the game. Like, I'm feeling lucky and wild.
By the way, breaking news. He Hate Me currently lives in Charlotte, North Carolina and is a counselor to high school students.
Is he with Grandmama in Charlotte? Another throwback, ladies and gentlemen, to the Charlotte Hornets.
I had both a Larry Johnson jersey and poster where he was in Grandmama garb dunking. By the way, I just realized Grandmama is indistinguishable from Madea of Tyler Perry fame.
Oh my God. You've just blown the minds of whatever percentage of the population is black.
And what percentage of this listenership is black?
Well, we crested at about 75% last episode. We're slowly phasing out the white people to make way for more black listenership.
That would be awesome.
It would actually be really fun to do that, because I think I've said it before, and you know this. I think black people are way more fun. I'm allowed to say it. I live around black people, and you don't, most likely, listener. That might be cut from the show.
Black people inherently are more fun. It's genetic.
It's true. I cannot stress this enough. I've never had more fun in my life than when I'm with black people. They just know how to have fun. When things look like they're going to be bleak, they're the most... I don't want to... Why am I still talking about that?
Racial.
But it's true. Yeah. Okay, drivers go flat out, pushing horsepower limits behind the wheel of high-concept supercars in an all-out blitz over tarmac and dirt. Shooters push firepower limits in high-tech military-grade turrets, covering their driver, taking out opposing vehicles and turrets, jockeying for the most advantage... They spelled it advantageous wrong, but all right... turn positions around the track. Okay, so you get that. You get the idea. Basically, it's teamwork, intensity, vehicle countermeasures like flares and chaff. How do you say that word? I'm bad.
I think it's chaff, isn't it?
Chaff? I think so. I think that's what it is. To fend off incoming fire from opposing team turrets, a steady aim and on-track power-ups that provide an upgradable edge for shooter weaponry are needed to capture the checkered flag and championship glory!
Every What's Dropping is filled with these kinds of games that there is this myth of who is buying and interested in games. That, like, these press people still believe that we're all 15 years old and, you know... looking at catalog, like Guns and Ammo catalogs or something, and Steve Roken, when it's not the case anymore. No one gives a shit about this stuff.
I think they also mistakenly believe that they're going to change my mind suddenly about what I think about these games. I have a good idea of what goes on in this game, and I also know that I won't care for it. So this whole selling me on this shit, it's BS. I'm not going to be sold. They go on to say, here's what the big picture is. They go on to give a gameplay summary. I'm not even going to get into that because the big picture basically summarizes everything I said. Drivers and shooters work together to win a race. You know, there's on and off-road racing environments. None of this... I'm already walking out the door. If I'm at a convention and you're trying to sell me on this, I have already rejected your flyer and told you to set it down. I'm not taking it from you because I'll just throw it away. I'm moving on to the next desk where hopefully there's a good-looking French girl just like we encountered when we were at the Small Press Expo. If you're out there, I'm secretly in love with you. I don't know what happened to you, but... one day we'll reunite.
You were obsessed. That was legendary.
She was a good gal.
No, here's the thing about these stupid-ass what's droppins. Think about it this way. It's like, because all this description is just genre description. It's like if the new, you know, Jason Statham movie comes out. And the way they sell it to you is by saying, there's guns. He punches a guy in the face.
Look out for the slow-mo shot.
There's an assault rifle at one point. He steals a car. That's how games are sold to us, is listing all these features that are just part of genre convention. That's not interesting. It's genre, generic. We don't care. We assume this. Tell us what's unique or interesting. By the way, it doesn't exist. I understand your problem. Maybe you shouldn't be making a game.
I'm not even going to get into the rest of this.
But yeah, who... I want to imagine who they're thinking sees epic explosions and spectacular crashes. And, like, they imagine this person who's excited by that. In a world in which I witnessed the stuff I did at Experimental Games Workshop at GDC, where does that put this? When there are people rethinking what a game even means or can do, it's unbelievable.
These people have no place.
Yeah.
I want to move on. What's the second segment that we do? It's what's dropping, then what happens? don't tell me. Top Sizzlers is third.
No, Top Sizzlers is second.
What's third? Oh, off the hot off the wire. Yeah, I do this. I edit this podcast. Don't worry about it. Hey, Tanner. This is some Top Sizzlers. And I wanted to bring this up because you know about these sorts of things. This comes from cinemablend.com. The headline reads this: video games make you more racist, study says. Have you read this study?
I've seen earlier studies that say the exact same thing. So this is nothing new.
Oh, see, now I thought for me, as I played games, I don't think I became more racist at all. I think but maybe I wasn't racist in the first place. Maybe that's the issue.
Well, what the studies essentially say is that if someone plays games that depict different races or ethnicities in stereotypical ways, that the person is likely to start perceiving those stereotypes in real life, which... you know, this is always advertised as, oh my god, video games. But this is the same kind of thing with any media. You know, people who consume racist bullshit, if they don't have the proper context and critical faculties to process racist bullshit, they may start believing that racist bullshit is true, you know?
So this study basically confirms it because they had different groups. So in one group, they had a group of 126 white students play Saints Row 2, and they were randomly given a black or a white avatar to play as. And then they were asked to perform a violent mission, you know, like you break out of prison or whatever. And then others were asked to just find a chapel within the city in Saints Row 2. So, you know, so they were paired up. Black avatar means you get a violent goal. White avatar means you get to go find God or whatever it is. But they were more likely to be in agreement, those students who played with a black avatar, they were in agreement with the statement that if blacks would only try harder, they could be just as well off as whites. This scares me. I'm sorry to say, ladies and gentlemen, that this is... Like, I would play that and I'd go, no, I was playing as a black fake, you know, like, avatar. And even if you gave me a white person or a girl and that's what I had to do, I wouldn't generalize.
Yeah,
anyway.
I would hope... I mean, this sounds like poor science, but I would hope they had, like, a control and everything. Because, I mean, how do you measure against these people's preconceived notions,
right,
that are being brought in versus how the game is engendering this kind of thought, you know? But I imagine, God, I would hope that they're correcting for that kind of thing.
Yeah, I can't confirm whether or not they did that. I'm not seeing here where they had a control group and what the results were for that. However, there was, interestingly enough, there was a second experiment where they had... Now, keep in mind, these numbers are low, ladies and gentlemen, in terms of... look, I took statistics at a community college nearby, so I know what I'm talking about when I say this, but the group that was being sampled was, in the first instance, 126 white students. In this next instance, I'm going to reference is 141 white students, of which, in this second example, 65% were female. Which I think is interesting. So they have an overabundance of vagina playing this game, and they played either WWE SmackDown versus Raw 2010 or Fight Night Round 4, and once again they were assigned either a black or a white character. After the game, the students were given a different version of this implicit association test, which I don't know if you're familiar with that, but I think that's what dictates whether or not you're... It's what tells us whether or not you're a racist. And they were shown pictures of black and white faces alongside pictures of weapons or nonviolent objects like cameras or phones. I'm reading from the story. The group that had played as black avatars more commonly associated black faces with weapons. What's more, students who played a violent game with a black avatar showed more aggression than the students playing with a white avatar, because during the pit fight that followed... That's not true. I was going to try to carry on.
I love the term pit fight. That needs to be the name of our next podcast after this one fails.
There's so much that is associated with the idea of a pit fight. Like if I came home one day and I was like, Tanner, I got in a fight today, you'd go, oh man, that sucks. What happened? If I said, Tanner, I got in a pit fight today, that brings a whole host of circumstances that remain unexplained.
Yeah, that, I see, first of all, there's got to be a pit, and there's got to be a very greasy guy wearing a vest and no shirt underneath taking money.
Right, and there's a whole host of people who are saying, you know, I'm putting money on the pasty white guy from Detroit, or whatever, however they characterize me. Pit fighting brings up a whole imagery that I just love.
I've always wanted to be one of those people gripping a wad of cash and just yelling at something. Like,
I wish I could even try to yell. I'll just sound like I'm trying to talk in tongues if I do it. But they have there needs to be a linguistic study on this. Like, there's a whole thing going on there. I think the point of this story is that violent games breed violent people, and violent people are black.
Yes. You did a very good job of parsing that study. I'm going to cut that out, just that portion out, and just blast it over the internet. Soundbite.
Oh, my God. I'm a horrible person. Okay, before we get into this, there's still, ladies and gentlemen, there's a big story coming up that we need to talk about. Absolutely, we need to talk about
maybe
it. And I'm
Hot off the wire can just fuck off.
All I was going to say, really quickly, Telltale Games, they're doing Game of Thrones. It will not take place with the characters that you know about. It will be concurrent with the characters that we know about. So the setting... And all of that stuff will be in place, but you will be in a world that is couched within the world that George R.R. Martin and that David Benioff and D.B. Weiss have created in the show. In other words, You will not play as a main character when you play Telltale's Game of Thrones. You will play as a new character. This is what they did with their Walking Dead game. You play and you sort of circle around and sometimes every so often interact with the main characters that you would find in The Walking Dead. So I imagine with Game of Thrones, you're not going to just be completely isolated from the main storyline, but you will not be involved entirely in it. I think that's kind of cool, and hopefully it adds more to the lore. I love the idea of building lore around stuff, so I'm pumped about that. Do you have any comments, or do I move on?
No, I agree.
Okay, next one also is about a similar thing, which is, you know, Electronic Arts has been given carte blanche to make Star Wars games, and so they're going to give Star Wars games the, quote, Batman Arkham-style treatment. Again, they want to deliver what they call, quote, deep and immersive storylines. And just like with Telltale, they will not be doing something that is directly involved with Star Wars. It will simply be you playing a character within the same setting, but circling the main storyline somehow. I'm for it. Okay. Now.
I like that we're just getting updates on what recently announced games you are for and against.
This is the biggest news to ever hit the Super Dumb Games podcast. Mark Zuckerberg, Nerdstrom extraordinaire, he has purchased a beloved intellectual property that we once thought would possibly suck our penises.
I once experienced it milking me too greedily. Milking me dry to the point that I was but skin and bones.
It was announced just 12 hours ago. That's why we're doing this podcast on a Wednesday. It's pressing news, but it's not so pressing that I'll release this in the next couple days. It'll still be released on a Monday, so sorry. But Mark Zuckerberg announced on his official Facebook blog thing, whatever. I don't use Facebook. But he announced that they acquired the Oculus Rift virtual reality technology. This has resulted in a near shitstorm among the gaming community. And before I give my impression of this, I guess, Tanner, I'd like to hear yours. I think maybe you might have the same tempered response that I do. But maybe not. Maybe you're anti-Facebook or whatever. I don't know.
I fucking hate Facebook. I think it's utter shit. I think by far it is the worst social network that exists today. I am leaving it immediately. It's terrible. Everyone on it is terrible.
You're making the move to classmates.com. Finally, I've been telling you all this time. Many years that you should come join me.
Zuckerberg is terrible. But all that said, I think ultimately this may be the best thing for virtual reality. I think that something like Facebook that touches such a broad mass of the gaming population, you know, it's been shown that people 55 and up are rushing into Facebook. They're playing games on there. I think there's maybe a billion users or something fucking nuts. Ugh. On Facebook. It's insane. But they have not only a pile of insane money, but huge reach that could make sure VR doesn't just become motion control style gimmickry, but something that has broad applicability across gaming and social media and just the way we interact and Skype and all of this kind of thing. I trust in John Carmack and Palmer Luckey and the dudes who are kind of in charge of Oculus that they're making a decision that they feel is going to push this technology in a way that trumps or at least cuts around what Sony's doing. I mean, this whole deal was made during GDC while Sony's announcing their VR or just after. And I think Oculus was like, oh, fuck, we got to do something big. And their board pushed them. And they're like, well, let's go in this direction because this is crazy. They got tons of money and this may make VR into this whole other thing. I'm super excited about VR. And I think we've got, you know, it's sad that Oculus, which was crowdfunded and was going to be this kind of, you know, populist version of VR, got bought out by something that's evil and fucking awful like Facebook. But I think in the end, it'll help make sure VR doesn't just be a flash in the pan.
First off, you hit on one issue, which is, as it stands now, obviously the Oculus Rift was exclusively a gaming sort of component. And what Mark Zuckerberg talks about in his post is that he feels as though that this can, as he says, we can, quote, share unbounded spaces and experiences with people in your life. And so I think he's envisioning this to go not just, it's going to go beyond gaming. It's going to go to classrooms. And he even says going to your doctor and having a face-to-face, quote unquote, with your doctor. Now, I think that's just somebody who's youthful and stupid talking about virtual reality. But that's my only opinion on it.
Yeah, I don't, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is not Steve Jobs.
No, he doesn't. He's not. So to get to my point, I imagine the developers of Oculus Rift are walking into the Shark's Tank, and Mark Zuckerberg happens walking into the Shark's Tank right now. I mean, I love Shark's Tank.
The thing about Oculus is there is something proprietary about it.
That's what I was going to say. So it's proprietary. This is worth investing in. That is why I think Mark Zuckerberg has done this. He is taking a page out of the Kevin O'Leary handbook and is making a wise investment. But I would like to think he also knows to not fuck with it. And when I say that, I mean this. I think this acquisition is simply a way to pump capital into an existing product that already has a buzz about it. Everyone is all a buzz about the Oculus Rift. In other words, he's not going to dictate to them, yeah, I mean, I'll take 30% of the company with a, but I'm going to take a 10 cent royalty on the back end of it. On the back end of it until I make my money back, and then from there it's 5% or it's 5% in perpetuity.
You truly think you're an expert on business now that you've watched
shit.
About 200 episodes of Shark Tank and Dragon's Den.
What I do know is if I took this podcast into the Shark's Tank, we would get denied. They would find nothing proprietary about this. They could hire any two stooges to host.
They'd get the extra secret podcast in here.
Take that bump, extra secret podcast.
You're welcome.
Very sparingly do we ever give the Super Dumb Games bump, but you just got one. But I think what he's looking at here is the fact that there is an opportunity. So I don't think what we're going to get is Farmville for the fucking sunglasses. You know what I mean? Like, that's not what we're getting here. We're getting somebody who has the capital to truly put money into this. Honestly, it could have been, I don't know, Richard Branson who said, I'm putting money into this. But you know what? He's more concerned with space travel. Godspeed, Richard Branson. I'm fine with that. But Mark Zuckerberg sees an opportunity to come in and possibly take the Oculus Rift into new territory that even the inventors of the Oculus Rift didn't think they could technically do because it was a crowdsourced thing. And the crowd overwhelmingly said, we want games with this. So I think in the beginning, we will see a lot of games developed for it. And then afterward, we might then see this turn into virtual reality in that way that we've always thought of it, which is it expands you to be able to, you know, we talked earlier about sports, you know, when we were talking about Caliber 10 racing, you might be transported to the very track that the Indianapolis 500 races upon, people. And every so often you can sort of shift your head left to right to watch as cars zoom by using your Oculus Rift. And you can drink that Budweiser from the comfort of your own Lazy Boy.
I've started, and hopefully we'll soon kickstart a game that I'm working on for the Oculus, Facebook Oculus Rift, which is Hot or Not Friends Baby Edition, where you just you get Friends' baby pictures blasting your left or right eye, and you've got to choose which one's the hottest. I want to be sitting back in a chair with my headset on, just in the most spectacular, otherworldly 3D environment, just getting a stream of people letting me know their marathon times. or whenever they're at the gym, like, just beam that into my brain. I, you know?
Yeah, let us know. I would be in on that. And I think it's too much work to port me in while you're working out. I would be a bit fatigued, I think, afterward. But if you can tell me how it went, you know, you basically put on your Oculus Rift, look in the mirror, and that's when I poured in, and I want to see results. And I'll follow you. I'll follow, you know, what are you getting abs? No? Okay, whatever. Did you do too much cardio and your tits are going down in size? Show me your tits, you know? That's, oh, God. I could do Hot Off the Wire, but honestly, the only thing I found was this headline, and that's where it'll end. Budweiser and Ozzie Smith surpass 100,000 signatures at whitehouse.gov petition to make opening day a national holiday. I just love that Ozzie Smith is still in the national dialogue. I once had him as a starting line. What was that? What were those figures called? Starting lineup? Those action figures? Yeah. He was my, like, golden glove shortstop. He was mid capturing a ball as it was being hit between shortstop and third base, I think was the pose. Ozzie Smith still kicking it after all these years. That's your news.
Segment with this provocation. What makes a Japanese game? What characterizes Japanese game design? And I want to take up that question, but first, let me say our last discussion about mind-blowing games blew up
hot
on superdumbgames.com.
I've never seen so much action. I was literally responding like every minute. It was incredible.
So I'd say check out that discussion, which is on superdumbgames.com. But also, we encourage you for this discussion about what Japanese games are and mean. I encourage you on the posting for this episode to put your comments there, and we can have it. We can continue the discussion and fill out lists of games or design techniques, that kind of thing that you feel characterizes Japanese games. Now, this discussion was initiated by Dark Souls 2. And I think, you know, I don't want to essentialize Japanese game design because, of course, it's very, very varied. You can't say that this is or isn't definitively what Japanese game design is, but you do have to account for differences. There are cultural differences. Just like in art, there are certain trends and themes that carry through. And I think that's really fascinating. With Dark Souls, you see it in that I think one of the trends you could say with Japanese games are that they respect the player in a way that you don't often see in other games. And what I mean by that is they allow the player to figure shit out. And I love them for that.
Can this be tied into what my first thing was with what differentiates like a JRPG or a Japanese game in general? I think it can tie in with Japanese games are more difficult. Some of them are difficult to an extreme, but I think American games often hold your hand. And games like Dark Souls, or when I played Demon Souls, that game was unrelenting and it wasn't what I thought I was purchasing. I thought I was purchasing an American game, basically. And I say that in the sense that where it was a game where I would progress through levels and I would see the progress of my brother as we played together. All of this other shit. And that ties in, by the way, to the whole like gaming with my brother thing. But that's a whole nother story. But difficulty, I think, is a huge difference between how Americans approach gaming and how the Japanese approach, especially game development. And I think a part of that is sometimes you're insulting my intelligence, American game developers, or even European game developers, to be honest. You're insulting my intelligence when it comes to certain games. I don't need my hand held so tightly. Whereas Japanese developers, I think, give you that freedom to get the shit kicked out of you and learn from that experience and become better as a gamer.
Yeah, and certainly there are super difficult games made from all over the world, but with traditional Japanese game design, there seems to be this feeling, there seems to be this respect for, I think, what the essence of games are, which is that the player figures shit out. One of the fun things about a game is making discoveries, unpacking the system, and unraveling mysteries in it. And I was watching, this was at that Experimental Games Workshop as well, there were these designers talking about cognitive and neuroscience, saying that chemically, it's more pleasurable for the brain to kind of, to really boil it down, to create new pathways rather than retread old ones.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that makes sense. I want to improve. I want to get better at stuff like this.
So, you know, what a game like Dark Souls does is it takes a familiar context, but then forces you to figure all of it out. Whereas something like Dragon Age or Mass Effect, every step of the way, it's telling you, okay, here's what you're doing. This is what you now need to do. Here's what you're doing. This is what you now need to do. Where Dark Souls is like, here's the system. Figure out all the secrets. It's like a mystery box that you unpack.
I've watched many videos online, and even games as simple as, well, as simple as it was ported to the U.S., like a Dance Dance Revolution, let's say, just as an example. I've seen that played on the highest difficulty mode in Japan, and it seems like that is more difficult than what you would ever see anyone here in the States do. I've also seen somebody play a game that was similar to like a Vanguard or an R-Type or what, you know, a side scroller where you're where you get power-ups and you're killing beasts that come from the right side of the screen. I've seen people somehow navigate through what seemed impossible odds and beat the game, but it speaks to the fact that that person probably invested I don't know, like hundreds of hours of their life into that game. It's not appealing to 99% of gamers, but for that 1% of gamer that is so into that, I did this with VVVVVVV. I 100% of that game because, you know what, it didn't I think that actually struck a balance where you could beat the game and have the, you know, have the sense of accomplishment. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I've seen things you people wouldn't believe.
What kind of where were you at when you saw these things?
Attack ships.
Oh my god.
Off the shoulder of Orion.
I've been there before. It's all right. I just, at the time there were no attack ships. Go on.
So the second thing that I was, that really came to mind when I was thinking about this was how, and this is one of the things I love about Metal Gear Solid, which is so Japanese. One of the things I love about Metal Gear Solid is it's crazy. It's nuts. And that, you know, a lot of that has to do with, well, I'm American. I come from a certain cultural context and perceive things a certain way and have certain conventions. And Metal Gear Solid makes some gestures to American media and film and certainly adopts and appropriates all that stuff, but then it always goes really hard on the Japanese craziness tip, you know, with monkeys and diapers and people wearing gas masks and just insane stuff that you have to... To really appreciate that stuff, you have to have a kind of global perspective. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that this is a different kind of cultural production, and to appreciate and indulge in that, to really love it.
So you're telling me that if I play these games that you have been spouting off to me that they're amazing, I'm going to encounter a monkey in a diaper? This did not sell me on Metal Gear Solid or any of the other Metal Gear series. I don't want to play a game where there's a monkey. This didn't do it for me. The fact that you're trying to do it for me does it for me. But
there, and that's just the tip of the iceberg with those games. There's all this stuff where you kind of get this squint on your face and you just watch it unravel. And you like, what is happening? Why is that guy wearing high heels, a trench coat, nipple clamps, and carrying a revolver? What?
I think that brings up the aesthetics of Japanese games, which I still, you know, they have their own artistic style. I mean, literally, it is it's like Disney versus whoever is famous in Japan. I don't know, but that's how it is. But that's what it is. Like, if I can make a better analogy, it would be like going to an art gallery and you're in the realist gallery, and then, you know, so you see all this realism, and then you go to the impressionist gallery. And sometimes, like, with Japanese art styles, it's more impressionist than realist. I don't know. Like, physics don't matter. There's dudes who carry swords that would break your collarbone if you rested it upon it, but they rest that shit like it's going to, like, it's nothing for them. They must have the strength and dexterity that I will never possess, but in Japanese games, they can do that kind of stuff. I just, in American games, it feels like there is more of a realism or an attempt to recreate realism that Japanese games don't feel like they need to abide by.
Yeah, I get that. I think there's, and that realism within American made games, take Gears of War for instance, it's an exaggerated,
it becomes
realism.
Absurdism in, but it's within the constructs, yeah, of the real world. You know, they'll have a gun that's totally absurd, but I guess I could hold that gun. I don't know.
Because if you look at their bodies, they're huge. I mean, the leg of a guy in Gears of War is like a tree trunk.
And actually, in most JRPGs and things like that, they're very slender. Very slender folks.
Yeah, and that's one of the really interesting progressive things. You know, Japan gets a lot of flack for the representation of women and girls in particular. They're often very sexualized and made to be diminutive and that kind, mm-hmm, of thing. But if you look at their portrayal of masculinity, especially in JRPGs, masculinity is relatively progressive compared to an American style of masculinity.
It's pretty feminine, the masculinity in JRPGs.
It's often a mix. Like, you have your... And I think it's coded in a way that when you look at a traditionally masculine character, often those characters will be associated with a U.S. nationality or a European nationality. Mm-hmm. And then a different kind of masculinity, you know, what we would perceive as more feminine, is coded as an Asian masculinity. Yeah.
What else do you have?
So, one of my favorite games of all time...
Xenogears?
Is Xenogears.
Yes!
And it is so Japanese. And what's really... why it stuck out to me about that game, compared to other RPGs I was playing at the time, and even JRPGs, was how risky it was narratively. Like, Xenogears had this really deeply anti-religious message embedded within it, and that was something that you would have never seen embedded within, at the level of complexity as well as the level of message in any American-made game at the time, any mass-market American-made game. And it made me think, and I don't know if this is quite true, but I feel like Japanese story and narrative, especially in the 80s and 90s, was often a bit riskier and a bit more critical and dark. And people who study anime often attribute this to the end of World War II and atomic bomb and the kind of after effects and psychological effects of having gone through that kind of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And that those effects can be seen and read in a lot of different anime, Akira being probably the most prominent, that is just full of darkness and depression and a critical take on the military-industrial complex. But I feel like that kind of current of a deeper, larger, more gray perspective on the world weaves into a lot of the games as well.
Yeah. I'd like to point out one of the better subplots in Xenogears, and I haven't played this in years. It's one of those games that I always want to play, but I know I'm going to sink like 100 hours into it if I do. But there was this whole subplot about one of the characters who was disowned by his father, and that was a pretty... As a dude, that's a pretty heavy thing to go through when you're a kid as you're watching this thing happen. I don't know. I don't know if you remember that. It happens at some point during the story. I can't remember the character or the circumstances. I just know that it happens. And I'm not saying that American games would shy away from that, but I wonder if they would handle it with kids' gloves in the proper way. Like, they would... Yeah. You know?
I feel like they've gotten better at tackling those kind of issues, but at that point in time, you could only find that kind of that deep story in those JRPGs, and that's why they were so wonderful. But then they stagnated, you know, and we just haven't they haven't quite captured the zeitgeist of the current day, and unfortunately, we've moved on to things like Mass Effect, which. You know, a lot of people love for its story and its characters, and I just don't get it. I played all three of those games, and it just...
Oh, you even played Mass Effect 3. You went through the end. See, I quit after 2.
And that I would recommend you not playing 3. I think 2 was by far the best of those games. But still, I wouldn't say... With all of the progression we've made in games, I don't feel like Mass Effect 2's story is better than those classic JRPGs.
It's not. I quit, but it wasn't because I was like, it'll never get better than this. It was because I was like, I don't want to do another game anymore of this. I was done. And I think, I don't know, maybe that just has to deal with more substance issues. I wish... that our games were packed with more. It felt like there was a lot of fluff going on.
Yeah.
So
we'd love to hear the community bin's take on this.
You mentioned it earlier. It blew up. And I just want to give a shout out to those who helped blow it up. That would be Derek and Rudy and, boy, I can't name all 1,500 of you at this time, but we talked about
Louise.
Louise was little baby. Louise made a comment with her mom making eyes toward us.
No, she made a comment, and then her mom just replied, "Oh, Louise."
But there was an interesting conversation about Rocksmith. I think is the name of the game, right?
Yeah.
And I'd like to. I'm not even going to talk about it because you should be talking about it on the website. Go to www.superdumbgames.com. When the podcast is uploaded, you can have as many comments as you want. We will interact with you.
There's not a cap on comments.
That, as far as I know, I'm looking at the dashboard right now. To my knowledge, it doesn't say there's a cap on comments, and we have reached a critical mass on comments on the last one, so they're still saying we're good to go. If you want to comment on the last one, go in and comment on it. We talk about, first off, I'm a virtuoso on guitar. I don't know if you knew that about me, but it's true. And then we began talking about Rocksmith, a game that potentially could make you a better guitar player, or in the case of someone like yourself, Tanner, where you kind of blow at guitar, you know, maybe maybe you
what's
can...
That, what's that like to blow at guitar? Being a virtuoso, it's been so long.
I can only imagine what it would be like to hit a fret and it sounds dead as you hit it. I recollect that happening when I was trying to play Cemetery Gates circa 1994. But so go to superdumbgames.com, comment on stuff. What else do we have?
Go on iTunes, post a written review. The Frosted Glass rant from episode 22, that story is up on YouTube for your listening pleasure. Please share it with friends to get them into the podcast.
It's hilarious. What else do you want from us? Every week we ask of you people one thing. Tell a pal. Just, you know, tell a pal. You'll get a tote bag. If it doesn't work out with that pal... I don't have anything to say about this. I'm done. I thought I had a riff. I don't have anything.
Dumb games.